This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
I'm Helen Farmer. Great to have you with us. And we're talking ADHD misdiagnosis following researchers in the UK finding that teachers and parents might be confusing the immaturity of younger children with symptoms of ADHD. Educational psychologist and senior occupational therapist, plus you guys joining us live to unpack that. We were discussing Ozempic babies, the link between obesity and infertility with Dr. Mariam Awate. Text lines were open on that healthcare topic too. And the hidden dangers in your home. Do you need to know more about EMF? That's electromagnetic field radiation. An expert was in the studio. And in light of the tragic passing of Dr. Michael Mosley, where heatstroke has been implicated as a cause of death, how does our body respond to extreme temperatures? Internal medicine specialist Dr. Wajdi Abjani joining us live. Really compelling topic to discuss today, potential misdiagnosis of ADHD in children due to developmental immaturity, often in children who are young for their year. Joining us, we've got a senior occupational therapist and an educational psychologist to shed light on a recent study out of the UK that suggests that younger children in the classroom are often mistaken as having ADHD when they simply might be less mature than their peers. We're also going to be talking about what is available to those who have got a diagnosis of ADHD. The text lines are open, so exploring the implications of these findings and what can be done to ensure an accurate diagnosis. Joining us from Insight Psychology, we've got Miriam Maddy, senior occupational therapist and educational psychologist, Dr. Leanne O'Brien, joining us on Teams. I'm really grateful for your time. I know how busy you are over there at Insight because we hear you recommended all the time. So I'm really thrilled we were able to steal you away for what I think is a really important topic to kind of shed some light on. Dr. Lam, could we start with you? Would you mind unpacking some of the main findings of this study mentioned, saying, you know, ADHD misdiagnosis and children's immaturity? What do we need to know about this?
Absolutely. So I think what's really important to know is that there are so many other challenges and differences that can be misread as ADHD. Immaturity is just one of those things. So this is not something which is new to us. This is just something else to kind of add onto that kind of list of things that we're always going to be holistically looking for as part of a wider assessment. Mm-hmm. We know that there are other things, for example, such as anxiety and trauma, for instance, that can cause differences with inattention and what can look like maybe impulsivity, for example. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's so important that children with behaviour differences are evaluated thoroughly and carefully, and that effective diagnosis benefits everybody. And of course, here at Insight Psychology, that's exactly what we do. We are constantly evolving our practice for assessing ADHD, keeping up to date with latest research and knowledge and understanding of assessment tools. And I think also...
No, I'm just going to say I need to get an understanding later on exactly of that diagnostic process. I think there's a bit of fear or, you know, what happens behind the door, right? That I think it's really important to kind of demystify that for parents listening today. So if you don't mind, we'll get to that bit soon, if that's okay, Leanne.
Yeah, absolutely. And I also think as well that, you know, throughout history as well, it's really we need to get that nuanced understanding of what a child's behavior is. And I think that when we're looking at immaturity, and this is something that came out from the study, the biggest difference between children with ADHD and those who are just immature is likely how much their behavior is impacting in their lives. Mm. So how much is that impacting in the home life? Because they're not being able to do what their parents are asking them to do, and parents become frustrated, or are they unable to participate in sports or can't follow rules? Do they get excluded from play dates? And what the study has actually pulled out is that there's teachers and also parents as well that struggle with that understanding of what is immaturity and what actually is ADHD and making that misdiagnosis. So we have got such a responsibility as practitioners to make sure that we are educating our communities around us to make sure that we are letting them know what is normal in terms of developmental expectations.
Well, let's even zoom out further, because Sammy's saying, let's explain what ADHD is. And I want to come to you, if you don't mind, Miriam, in just a few minutes and talking about some of the immaturity pieces that we're talking about in this study. But would you mind explaining that from an educational psychologist point of view, Dr. Leanne? because the H was added in. We've got ADD, we've got ADHD. There's still a lot of confusion about this kind of so-called labelling. Would you mind explaining for us? And I know this is your bread and butter, but can you break it down?
Yeah, absolutely, of course. So ADHD stands for Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder. And as you say, people get very confused with this because they see that H in there. And the ADHD is actually an umbrella term. So it encompasses different types of ADHD, such as the inattentive presentation that historically people know as ADD. So sometimes people are more familiar with that. ADHD, the hyperactive impulsive presentation. And sometimes people have a combined presentation. And now ADHD is what we call a neurodivergence. So somebody who is neurodivergent refers to a person whose brain wiring is different to the majority, and the majority we would call neurotypical. So neurodivergence is just that. It's a neurological divergence away from what is most common. And one of those variations, of course, is ADHD. And that can be manifested with challenges with attention difficulties, with inattention, difficulty with executive function skills. So that means things that you need to do everyday tasks like time management, organization. And it can also manifest itself in terms of impulsivity and hyperactivity.
Thank you. Explained beautifully. I wanted to ask you, Miriam Maddy, a little bit about, from an occupational therapist perspective, what are some of the key differences between some of those ADHD symptoms and typical developmental immaturity? Can you explain from your point of view?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, it's so complex in little kiddos because we're not expecting them to, you know, go into secondary school and manage their time, their schedule. You know, these are things that are happening within the classroom. So like, for example, you know, forgetting their water bottle, forgetting to put on their socks, you know, these things are impacting these kids' everyday life and sometimes their confidence. So when we think about immaturity, we think about maybe a little bit of forgetfulness. And as Leanne mentioned, to what extent is that impacting a child's everyday life? Is it something that's happening so frequently that there is, you know, their confidence is being affected by that, you know? And Leanne also spoke about impulse control, and that's something that's really, you know, evident in some of our kiddos that are really struggling with that social interaction and maintaining friendships. And I guess that impulse control can again look like immaturity, but it goes past a certain point where, like Leanne said, you know, they are being excluded from play dates and, you know, it is affecting their everyday life. So it's tricky in our little kiddos because their responsibilities aren't huge, but as they progress and develop and, you know, more demand is put on them in school, you know, I mean, kids from 6 to 7, the level of demand that changes within the school year is unbelievable. And I feel like that's where we start to really identify, okay, we're struggling with, you know, keeping on top of tasks, with remembering to get our homework done, and, you know, and that builds and, you know, kind of can manifest in anxiety, like Leanne mentioned as well. So I guess when we think of ADHD, we think of the why. Why is this child acting immature, inverted commas? You know, are they struggling with executive functioning? Are they struggling with beginning a task and completing it to the end and then getting really frustrated? Does immaturity look like emotional dysregulation and feeling really overwhelmed at the end of a school day and having a meltdown? So I guess we really look at the why and understanding why is this child having these struggles? And is it, you know, are we able to put things in place where the child is able to manage? Or is it actually over time we're seeing it get a little bit more difficult as the demand increases within the school?
Right. OK, lots to unpack and lots of messages coming in on this topic. So do stay with us. That was Miriam Maddy, the senior occupational therapist at Insight Psychology, and a colleague, Dr. Leanne O'Brien. We've had messages saying, I feel like the term ADHD is being used too loosely nowadays. F says, I think that survey sounds accurate. A lot of people want the extra accommodations. D saying that the age for testing should be 7+. So I want to talk about that next. Talk talking about a study out of Nottingham in the UK, talking about the potential misdiagnosis of ADHD in children due to their developmental immaturity. And quite staggering numbers, to be honest, especially when we start looking at those children in a younger age group. So what do we need to know? In a nutshell, you will, of course, find kids that are noticeably older than their peers, but some confusion from teachers and parents about immaturity as being a sign of ADHD. So it's been published in the European Child and Adolescent Psychiatry Journal, revealed the youngest kids in their grade are striking 38% more likely to be diagnosed with ADHD than their older classmates. Joining us from Insight Psychology, we've got Miriam Maddy, and we have got educational psychologist Dr. Leanne O'Brien. And as I said, lots of messages on this topic. A message saying anxiety is commonly misunderstood in ADHD, as with my son. That's from Ella. We've also said totally, it's the brain's development. Super interesting. And he's saying, and then they box up the kids. The age for testing should be higher than 7. So let's talk about the diagnostic process. And Dr. Leanne, I'm very aware that you've got to dash off probably just after 7:30. So I'm going to focus on you first, because I've got questions from an OT perspective as well. What about testing? We were talked before about some of the common differences, so to speak. If a parent's listening today, or maybe it has been flagged at school, where or what is your first port of call to get an accurate diagnosis? And can you demystify that process for us?
Absolutely. So first of all, there is no one test for ADHD, and diagnosis actually comes from a variety of different sources as part of the assessment process. So depending where you go, what clinic you go to, they might have completely different processes. But where we always start with, and this is so important, is an initial consultation. So I know somebody mentioned in your questions about the age of diagnosis. Now, it's very rare, but we can do neurodevelopmental assessments for ADHD from as young as age 5. However, it's rare because that's something which we would quite often employ a watchful wait for things such as immaturity, for example. And I think that's so, so important. And also that gives us a chance to really unpick the developmental history. So this is where we'd start with the ADHD diagnosis, a thorough history to get a nuanced understanding of that young person's behaviour, how it's developed over time. What were they like when they were 2 or 3 or 4? Is this the first time the issues have come up? Have teachers mentioned this? So that's really, really important. And we can also start to unpick that further through the next part of the assessment. So once we've had the initial consultation, we can say, is this the most appropriate pathway for you, first of all? Should you be going down an ADHD pathway for assessment, or should you be going elsewhere? Is there something else we should be looking for? Are there other interventions, strategies, behavioural support that we should be employing first, because it might be a little bit premature to do so? We would then also collect a variety of different information from different sources. And this is so important that actually what we do as Insights is that we have a multidisciplinary team. We're not just taking, like what the article said, just what the teachers are saying or what they are seeing, because sometimes they can over-exaggerate or they can miss things as well. So actually, if we flip this the other way, I would even say that sometimes there is an underdiagnosis of ADHD because some things can be missed. We also have a look at not only what the teachers are seeing, but what are we seeing? We will go into the classroom. We will observe that young person. We'll have a wider team, such as Miriam, for example, who will be testing that young person around executive function skills. What is their ability to maintain attention, their ability to stop being distracted, all the executive function skills that we need to be able to maintain attention. So what is she seeing in the clinic? And most importantly, the experts in that young person's life is the parents. Mm-hmm. What are the parents seeing? And we triangulate that information. And this is through a variety of quantitative information, qualitative information, visits to clinic, visits to the school, and diagnostic interviews to really unpick what behaviours that the adults and the young person are seeing, because to have them as part of that process and to give them that autonomy, because they know more about themselves than anybody else. They live Absolutely. Those lives.
Absolutely. I've got so many messages for you guys asking questions about processes, about support. Message here saying no one wants a diagnosis of ADHD for convenience. Misdiagnosis does sometimes happen, but often underdiagnosis is more of an issue, e.g. just diagnosing ADHD when there's also autism. So echoing what you're saying there, Dr. Leanne, extra time in exams has also been shown to not really provide any benefit, which is worth noting, but other accommodations are much more supportive. That is from someone who works in the field. That's from Victoria. Also had a message here saying the best way it was described to be about my son with ADHD was that their brain cannot filter out background noise, and that's why they struggle to focus. Miriam, you're nodding along there. I'm going to come to you a little bit about some of the things, and maybe you can demystify if a child is recommended to work with an OT such as yourself. What might happen in a typical session? Could you explain a little bit about that? And it's going to depend totally on the age, the stage of the child, but how can you work with a child with an ADHD diagnosis?
Absolutely. I guess it's important to highlight, actually, I have ADHD myself. I'm late diagnosed, but I suppose I'm going through that journey as well myself and understanding, you know, other adults in my life, putting things down to immaturity and actually never growing out of that immaturity, I guess, and really having really struggling with executive functioning throughout my life. And really being an advocate, I guess, for children who come to our services. So I guess my priority when I'm working with a child who comes to me and there's potential ADHD there, my main priority is really to advocate for that child, to help them understand where they're struggling and why, and to be able to, you know, allow them to explain what they need to be able to support themselves. So that can really start as young as five. You mentioned there that, you know, that the parent had said that it is an inability to tune out background noise. And sometimes people actually talk about, you know, attention deficit. Actually, it might be that we are unable to, we are actually paying attention to too many things in the environment and unable. Exactly, you know, and I, first-hand experience, you know, I can vouch for that. So I guess with our kiddos, my main goal is to teach them coping strategies on how to drown out that background noise. So lots of occupational therapy strategies look at, you know, sensory. So is that person's voice really bothering you? So like sometimes we can recommend noise cancelling headphones, or do you pay attention better with background music on? So everyone is a little bit different. There's no one tool to fix all. And it's really, really exploring and understanding each individual person and their sensory differences. So with ADHD, a neurodivergent brain, we also see some differences in sensory processing. Well, yeah, so it's very interesting, and we really have to unpick that. So for one child who has ADHD, they might absolutely love the sound of like a screeching car, and that helps them process. And for another child, that might just be the thing that tips them over the edge, you know. So I guess, again, you know, not using a blanket
terms.
Absolutely.
Well, Miriam, we're going to keep you with us. We've got lots to talk about, lots of questions coming in, lots of opinions coming in as well. So I'm also want to talk a little bit about late stage diagnosis. I think I know an awful lot of parents that have come to realise they've got ADHD through doing investigations for their children, especially women. Study out of the UK talking about misdiagnosis of ADHD in children, especially those who are young for their year. 38%, interestingly, misdiagnosed in that category. We're going to be speaking next to senior occupational therapist Miriam Maddy, who, as she said before, has ADHD herself. We're going to be talking about strategies you can put in place if you have had that diagnosis, and hearing from so many of you about your experiences of getting that diagnosis and life since. Melissa, joining us on the line, it was your daughter who was diagnosed. Tell us about the efforts that you had to go to really get to the bottom of what she was going through.
Okay, so it was quite a difficult process. Mm. When she was young at school, she was, we thought she was actually quite academically good, but then that really fell off quite quickly, and she just couldn't manage things as she progressed through school. Like, she didn't realise that assignments were due, so they didn't get done, and homework didn't get done. And there was a lot of things that happened in terms of her being inattentive at school. And she was never a girl to get into trouble for being noisy, so because she's quite an introvert, so she kept it all to herself. And then, I don't know whether this is chicken and egg, but she ended up with an eating disorder that complicated it a lot. And then when she was in high school, the fact that she had this eating problem meant that it was very difficult for her to get a diagnosis of ADD or ADHD. And so at the end point of this, when she was 17, she begged to go into a psychiatric ward of a children's hospital. And there she had the test again for learning disorders and things like that. I've forgotten mm-hmm. what it's called. But anyway, they decided she had ADD, not ADHD. And then we had to really try again to work with the fact that, yes, okay, she was struggling with an eating disorder, but she needed this medication because the medication is supposed to inhibit your appetite.
Oh, interesting. So far more complicated than with your daughter.
Yeah. So they thought that she was trying to get this diagnosis.
As a suppressant. Oh, gosh.
As an appetite suppressant. Yeah. So that was difficult. So anyway, when she was 17, they finally gave her the medication, and within a week, life was totally different for her.
Really?
It was amazing.
Transformative.
Yeah. Yes, and she's now... So that happened in her last year of school, and because she'd missed out on a lot of school, she didn't do very well in her final exams. But she's doing this program now through one of the universities in Australia, a bridging course, and she's just going so well.
She's getting
high marks. She's flying through it.
Oh, Melissa, but what a road it's taken to get to that point. My goodness. I mean,
yes. It
kind of comes back to what Merrin was talking there about being a real advocate for your kid, right? You know, not giving up on them and you know, knocking on doors and just knowing that, or them knowing that you're always going to be there no matter how tricky that path gets. What advice would you give to any other parents who are really kind of struggling to either get a diagnosis or are really struggling to get their head around, you know, what their kid might be going through?
Oh, I would say stick with it. Keep on going to a psychologist or a psychiatrist that you're happy and comfortable with. That was one of the really difficult things, but trying to find somebody that my daughter was comfortable talking about both things with. Mm-hmm. And so once we got there, that changed things a lot. So that would be my advice. Find someone that your child is comfortable with and that you're comfortable with.
I love that. That trust is so important because, you know, I'm sure they're talking to somebody about things they might not be able to even talk to themselves about. And, you know, those teenagers are fraught enough. Melissa, thank you so much for sharing your story. I'm really pleased that you and your girl are doing great. It's wonderful to hear it. You know, we hear about the numbers, we hear about the studies, but I think it's so, so impactful to hear about just how things can turn around with the right support in place. So thank you for joining us today. And we've also got on the line today, as I said, senior occupational therapist, Miriam Maddy. And you said earlier, Miriam, that you've had a late stage diagnosis of ADHD yourself. And can we talk a little bit about girls and masking? And as I said earlier, I know a number of women who are, you know, my age, 30s, 40s, who have had a diagnosis, actually post-pandemic, because it was during lockdown that they started to realise, you know, behaviours in their children. And when they looked into ADHD, they were like, I actually am ticking quite a lot of these boxes myself. Would you mind telling us a little bit about your journey to get a diagnosis and how it's been since you've had that quote-unquote label?
Yeah, absolutely. I guess, like you mentioned, you know, with some of the parents, you know, they realise that actually these behaviours are more prominent, like, over the time of lockdown especially, things were heightened. I guess for myself, growing up in a household that was neurodivergent, and, you know, my mom had ADHD for sure, looking back now, and my twin brother has ADHD as well. Because he expressed that in a way that was just a little bit more evident, like he was in fights, you know, he was impulsive, he was, you know, getting the report card home, and then I was kind of under the radar, I guess, you know, just a little bit of a daydreamer. You know, gosh, but Ireland back then as well was just such a different time. And so, like, my experience was getting the extra tutoring after school, you know. You know, she's bright, just like Melissa said, she's bright, but actually, you know, she's not handing her assignments in on time. So I guess a lot of motivation from home, but never really understanding why I wasn't reaching my full potential. And so I guess lockdown for me as well.
Was it really?
My husband and I are yin and yang, chalk and cheese, like absolute polar opposites. I think it works really well, but mm-hmm. actually it exposed a lot of the areas that I find challenging. And he really couldn't understand, like, can you not He's listening now. Can you not like put the cup in the sink? Or can you not see that mess in the corner? Or how did you lose your key again? Or, you know, when like these questions over time impacted my confidence, I'm thinking, oh, I did do that. But anyone in my life before never criticized it. You know, it was just, that's the norm. It's so interesting.
Well, I find it really interesting to think of. And again, I can't obviously speak of your experience or anyone else that's had a late-stage diagnosis, but I can only imagine actually how insightful it must be to have this jigsaw put together. I was just listening to a podcast called Parenting Hell last night, and it's Josh Widdicombe and Rob Beckett, comedians. And Rob Beckett was talking about he's recently undergoing a process of getting a diagnosis for dyslexia. And he was saying that, you know, he is... adjusted his life to avoid certain situations where he might find it stressful, where he might feel exposed because of what he, you know, was unable to do compared to other kids and teenagers and adults. And, you know, it's kind of really changed his perception of himself and also, you know, a bit more compassion for himself as a kid. Is that how kind of you felt? I think actually this is, it's making sense now. And, you know, I'm not broken. I'm not, you know, it's just how I am. It's just how I'm wired, as we said earlier.
Absolutely. Listen, we have a laugh and a joke about it now. Like literally this morning I was in the gym, my shorts were on backwards, my sock was inside out, like, and like we laughed about it. But two years ago, and I felt actually a bit emotional actually in the car driving to work today, just like 2 years ago I would have felt such shame and guilt and embarrassment, like, why did I do that again? And then my day starts off negative, and then, you know, maybe someone says I forgot to reply to a message, and it all just builds up. Mm-hmm. And now that I have that compassion and empathy, and like people are just like, Miriam, never change. Just like, love you the way you are. Someone commented on the sock picture, just like, never change. I'm like, it made me emotional because I'm like, I love who I am. Good. And I love my quirks. And I guess having the diagnosis allows other people to understand me and have empathy and compassion and understanding as well. And now we just laugh about it.
Love it. Here is Chandan, who has ADHD himself, reflecting on this study out of the UK, talking about misdiagnosis, especially in children who are young for their year, where teachers are getting it confused with immaturity.
That article is really bizarre. I think there's big confusion anyway. It's shocking if teachers are misdiagnosing people or labelling people with ADHD when they're not, if they're just misbehaving. There's a lot more to ADHD. ADHD is really deep. It's everything from trouble concentrating, emotional dysregulation, executive dysfunction, low levels of dopamine baseline. It's a lot. And typically girls tend to get misdiagnosed as it is anyway, because they tend not to be the hyperactive sort. So if teachers are sort of looking at it as, you know, kids misbehave, oh, they're ADHD, A, how many girls are getting misdiagnosed even more than they already were? And B, how many people with ADHD who aren't hyperactive, who might be boys, are missing out on getting diagnosed because the teachers are just looking at the classroom clowns, as you would say. In the UK, since the article's from the UK, it typically takes 1 to 2 years to get diagnosed because there's a huge waiting list. Unless you go via the private routes, but even then I've heard that, you know, the quickest is several months, sometimes 6 months. So it's a huge problem if all this is happening alongside the struggles that many people with ADHD, especially children, face as it is.
Yeah, Chandan there sharing his thoughts. And here is Uzma Aksa, who works as a coach around neurodivergence, giving her hot take on this piece of research.
Hi, Helen. We do feel like we fall into the trap of early diagnosis or misdiagnosis because of certain behaviours in our children. I think the main thing we should really focus on is allowing them to develop and grow naturally and organically in the environment, and giving them the opportunity to explore their surroundings before we make, assumptions and judgments about them being, autistic or having ADHD. So I think this is a very important conversation, and really it's important to carry on discussing this, because as educators, as parents, if we jump into this at a very early stage, we may be risking a lot of different things here and looking at, you know, missing a lot of different elements, I guess, of development and growth naturally.
Usma, who works in this space, sharing her thoughts. Just a couple of minutes left now with Miriam Maddy, who is a senior occupational therapist at Insight Psychology. What do you feel like over this last hour we haven't touched on that you think is really important to highlight around ADHD and indeed the diagnosis of it, Miriam?
Yeah, I guess just the, you know, that article does highlight like an over-diagnosis. And I guess really it's so important to identify that women who are underdiagnosed can present like later in life in you know, symptoms like depression and anxiety. So it's just really important to kind of reflect and think back on, you know, the executive functioning challenges throughout life. And as life increases, as life continues, demand increases. So like not being able to manage having children,
maintaining
a full-time job.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
It gets
and
more stressful.
I guess like that's, yeah, absolutely. And that's where maybe things start falling apart. Mm. And women are maskers. I guess you mentioned masking, and you know, that's a really like important area to focus on. Girls are so good at kind of trying to fit in and trying to be like everybody else.
Yeah, it's true.
People pleasers, absolutely. And that's where we miss again, and where we see the dysregulation when they come home from school. And, you know, even teachers a lot of the times will say, we don't see it in the school environment. And then parents are saying, I don't know how she managed all day because when she came home.
Different child.
You know.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Miriam, thank you so much for your take on this. And also on that topic of getting older, Victoria saying the relationship between estrogen and dopamine mean that many women are only diagnosed as they begin perimenopause, as this heightens some traits to an extent that they seek help. Really complex thing. I feel like we've only just scratched the surface, but thank you to everyone that joined the conversation. And Miriam, with being with us today, a senior occupational therapist at Insights Psychology. Really appreciate your time. Now, we've heard an awful lot about the impacts of Ozempic and weight loss injections recently. You know, rapid weight loss, some amazing success stories, but also things like lowered blood pressure, some gastro issues, Ozempic face. Yes, that's a thing. But now we're seeing a rise in stories of Ozempic babies, where women who use drugs like Ozempic, semaglutide, reporting unexpected pregnancies. So we are talking about the link between weight and fertility. But truthfully, it is a women's health clinic, and we can talk about all aspects of cycles, getting pregnant, staying pregnant, birth. It's all up for discussion today because we've got the fantastic Dr. Mariam Awatai in the studio. How are you, Dr. Mariam?
I'm very fine, Helen.
It's such a
pleasure to be back.
I love talking with you, and I would just want to give a little heads up to our listeners.
Aww.
It's always a very busy one.
Same.
Because I think you're really well known, obviously, for your expertise, but your warmth and your no-nonsense approach. And I feel like when we are talking about sensitive topics, that combination is really, really important, you know, making people feel safe.
That's correct.
So I would say if you do have a question and you don't put your name on it, I would urge you to get in touch sooner rather than later, because I always worry about running out of time with you, Dr. Mariam. So can we start with that? Can you explain how obesity in particular, if we're talking about clinical obesity, impacts fertility in both men and women? Let's start
Absolutely.
With the women.
Okay, let's start with the women. Okay, so obesity. It has been an epidemic for us. And actually, for women, obesity is not just impacting on our fertility. Obesity is the one single risk marker that if you look at any adverse outcome in women, you're going to find an obesity link. And that is, you know, starts with fertility, miscarriage rate, the chance to get diabetes, polycystic ovaries, some types of cancers. In fact, some would argue most types of cancers. Almost everything has a link and can be linked to obesity. And it's not just, you know, generalized obesity. It's actually obesity around our abdominal areas or trunkal obesity.
So this is when we're looking at that kind of, what is it called? Is it
where around your abdomen.
Around your organs.
Absolutely, around your organs, around the subcutaneous tissue around the abdomen is bigger, and it gives you the so-called cushionoid appearance, where women can have fairly slim arms, fairly slim thighs and legs, but very rounded trunkal appearance.
When you're all tummy.
Absolutely, around the
So this is around fat being around those organs, and that impacting, presumably, and altering hormonal levels?
Absolutely. absolutely. The hormonal homeostasis is changed. You will, women who are, you know, developing truncal obesity will develop a number of different situations, and it's related to really how they are able to deal with metabolism, abnormal glucose metabolism. The easiest and the simplest way to look at it is to look at it from the pathway of insulin resistance.
Okay.
Now, insulin resistance, basically, you're not diabetic. The woman is not diabetic. She's producing her own insulin from her pancreas, but they are not efficient. And so they are not able to push glucose back into the cells where they belong. And when we eat and we have what we think is a balanced diet, if we have resistance or some element of insulin resistance, then you're going to have higher circulating levels of glycogen, higher circulating levels of glucose. This has to go somewhere. Mm. And it breaks itself down into two pathways, really. And the one that we focus on is actually the sex hormone pathway.
Is this the case in men who are obese as well?
It's really interesting. So very similar, really very similar, except you've got to add on to men the fact that, in fact, before I even say that, I would actually like to say that obesity in women gives us the same cardiovascular risk factors and the same sort of coronary risk factors as men. So generally with women, we have higher levels of circulating estrogens, we have lower testosterone levels, you know, and we don't really put ourselves at risk of getting a heart attack.
Until menopause.
Until menopause, exactly. And if you add onto that mix obesity, then we start to take on the cardiovascular risk of men. So we start having a slightly higher risk of a coronary event. Hypertension becomes a little bit more. We start to have the anabolic symptoms because we have a higher level of circulating testosterone when we are obese. And this then gives us, you know, more problems with our bones, with thinning, everything. You know, there is nothing I can say to stress the fact of the strong linkage of obesity to adverse outcomes.
And it's funny you use the word stress there, because when I was overweight, a lot of it was, you know, you need to lose weight. And I was very stressed about it, which then made it even harder to lose weight.
Absolutely.
It was very, very challenging. What I would say is that I would think I was about 100 kilos when I got pregnant. And that was kind of, but that's, I think, is quite unusual, because I've had friends who are overweight and have, you know, gone through IVF, have tried to conceive naturally and found it really, really challenging.
Difficult too.
Just coming back briefly to the men, we've got this factor talking about kind of hormonal levels being disturbed. So that can impact, you know, quality of sperm mobility.
Correct.
I've also seen things like where the way that men can carry their weight can also kind of heat up the testes that can have an impact on sperm as
Correct.
Well. So there's a few different things going on there.
Correct. So obesity in men in terms of fertility and their reproductive and their ability to reproduce. I mean, it's not as the direct link as it is with women isn't quite there with men. But like you've already alluded to, they get a lot of problems in terms of, you know, what is the quality of their sperm? Are they going to have more motile sperms? Mm. Are they going to have more abnormal forms? Are they going to have morbidities like high blood pressure, like diabetes, and still, because we know that these conditions, because of the types of medications that they sometimes have to go on to, can also affect their ability to reproduce.
It's all good news, isn't it? Right, we're not just here to outline things and kind of you know, tell you the state of affairs. We're going to talk about some maybe
positive
solutions,
things.
But some positive things as well. So how might Ozempic and other semaglutide weight loss injections impact fertility? What are the kind of the latest numbers? What do we need to know about using it before in order to get pregnant, even using it during pregnancy, and then after breastfeeding and beyond?
Yes. Such a good question. Honestly, as gynecologists, traditionally, we always, as we alluded to, understood the risks of obesity. And we always tried to find ways to sort of succumb that. And traditionally, it was always lifestyle. It was diet. It was exercise. And then we had drugs like metformin, glucophage, which we used and almost, I would say, abused in this sort of circumstance. And it did work. It had some significant benefits, but it took time. And then we had the semaglutides. And initially, you know, old-fashioned gynecologists like me, we thought, no, we're not going to change practice that quickly. Why? We need to know more. We need more of the evidence. And it's true that the evidence is, there is a lot of evidence. There are small studies, but they are all so overwhelmingly in favor of using Ozempic fertility.
So you get to a healthy BMI. You get to or a healthy BMI. Whatever your measurement, whatever your doctor's saying.
And you spontaneously become pregnant. It reduces the chance significantly of needing ovulation induction, cycles, assisted cycles. If one used semaglutides, anything from 3 to 6 months prior to the time that they were trying to become pregnant, if their BMIs are high, and we look at BMIs of anything between 30 and 35 as something that you would require. The body mass index is what I meant. I need to say something with caution, though, and I need to say that there has been an explosion of the use of these types of drugs, like Wegovy, like Ozempic, like Mounjaro. And as I said, used with caution, used with a, you know, very clear-cut guide as to how much weight loss you are expecting. Traditionally, it should be about 10% of the existing weight. Looking at the timing of it, looking at the length of time the woman is going to spend on these drugs, it's extremely important. You have to have the targets.
I want to ask you about nutrition as well, because when people are eating far less, sometimes, and I know this from friends who've done it, who've been like, oh, I'm just going to have a bit of cheese and crackers for dinner tonight because I'm not very hungry.
For the whole day.
Yeah. Whereas, you know, we know when we're preparing our body for pregnancy.
Correct.
We really need to be making sure that's a nutrient-rich diet. So I guess what I'm saying is overwhelmingly positive. Under doctor supervision.
Okay. Used sensibly, it gives quite amazing results. Ozempic not just improves the sort of egg quality and ovulation ability for women, but it also reduces the risks for miscarriage as well. And so you will find, if you look at the cohort of women who have used Ozempic pre-pregnancy and those who haven't, for instance, in a group of women with polycystic ovaries, you will find that those who had semaglutides actually have a reduced risk for getting miscarriage
Is this because it, obviously that drug is not protecting you against miscarriage? It's because
egg quality.
Of quality. Wow.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Better ovulation, better egg quality, reduced risk for miscarriage. The benefit is just, you know, so long-lasting, so that we do recommend that you do not use semaglutides during pregnancy. But even those who stopped and during their pregnancies, they don't traditionally get the gestational diabetes, get the large for dates babies, and get all the sequelae that can happen if they develop these conditions in pregnancy. So it's very exciting. And I'm really looking forward to when the bigger studies come through and really go out of their way and show that using these drugs under a controlled and supervised circumstance actually makes a big difference.
No name on this message, Dr. Mariam, saying thank you for talking about this. Can you say what the risks are to using Ozempic type drugs during pregnancy, or is it just not studied so it's unknown and therefore best avoided because it's better safe than sorry? Also, what about using them during breastfeeding? Is it a problem to cut back on the volume of food and nutrients when you are growing or feeding a baby? Let's take that first one. So avoiding taking weight loss drugs during pregnancy, is there simply a lack of information right now? And is this message saying better safe than sorry? Or is there anything, any kind of hard evidence we can refer to?
You're so lovely. I think there is a little bit of both, but there is definitely evidence to avoid it in pregnancy. Ozempic on its own and drugs like Ozempic, semaglutides, the primary side effect that they have is nausea and vomiting. And then they also have several other side effects, such as the effects on your pancreas, a little bit of inflammation, the chance that gallstones may be a problem, etc. And more very severe symptoms like liver problems whilst using semaglutides like Ozempic. Now, in pregnancy, as you know, we have a condition called hyperemesis. Hyperemesis is normal.
We have enough nausea, thanks very much.
Yes, so you can imagine if you are taking a semaglutide during pregnancy, say in the first 3 months of pregnancy, this is likely to be exaggerated. Mm-hmm. And hyperemesis gravidarum can potentially be a very severe condition and can lead to quite significant significant complications to the baby and the mother. And of course, things like gallstones and cholecystitis.
Yeah, you want to be keeping things as kind of pared back
exactly,
as possible.
Exactly.
So the second part of that was saying, what about using during breastfeeding and cutting back on volume of food and nutrients when you're growing or feeding a baby?
Absolutely. I think you just answered that, really. So again, we wouldn't really recommend that you take Ozempic during breastfeeding, just as we wouldn't even recommend dieting during breastfeeding. The breast milk, the component of the breast milk is quite, it's tailored, individually tailored every mother to their baby. But the idea is that it should be rich enough in nutrient content, fat content, carbohydrate content to allow this baby to grow. And particularly mothers who are exclusively breastfeeding, really we do not want them to be on medication that will limit their calorific content.
So eat away, have that second sandwich.
Eat away, be happy.
That was such a myth. Breastfeeding helps you lose weight and burns calories. Sick. I've never been so hungry.
You're so lovely.
I was having like 3 breakfasts. I'd wake up, I have a marmalade sandwich, then I'd have Weetabix, and then I'd be like, oh, I could have a little 10 o'clock snack.
That's your body.
I didn't lose a single kilo. Absolute lies. Right, Dr. Mariam, let's continue with the text line. A message here saying, hi doctor, can HRT patches cause increased joint pain or inflammation flare-ups? I had the Marina Coil and HRT patches started 6 months ago and I have noticed an increase. Also received conflicting advice on whether HRT should be prescribed at the perimenopausal stage with just brain fog and irritability as the only symptoms at age 45. So let's tackle that first part.
Okay.
What do we know about joint pain and inflammation?
You're so lovely. So joint pain and inflammation is definitely related to the perimenopause and the menopause. These are significant symptoms. You will hear about the menopause syndrome, which involves quite severe joint pain and body aches. So using a patch, a HRT patch with estradiol, is going to make that better. Now, using a patch plus Mirena is a progestogenic drug. It contains levonorgestrel. It's inserted into the uterus and it stays there for 5 years. And it releases progesterone on a very regular, small amounts on a regular basis. But what you can sometimes notice is when you take progesterone can sometimes trigger some degree of swelling or some degree of, it's really just fluid and it pushes fluid into the joint space. And so this can sometimes make the joints more painful. And so it's a balance. And I think if the patient is really having issues or the woman is having real problems with joint pain, sudden onset joint pain, because she's got the Mirena in, it might be a good idea maybe to change the type of progesterone that she's using. But it's definitely not coming from the HRT patch.
Good to know. And coming to that point about, you know, can you be prescribed HRT when you are, this listener's 45 and reporting symptoms of only brain fog and irritability? If so, please write me a prescription.
It's such a lovely question.
Please.
It's such a lovely.
And the answer to that question comes back to the fact that the perimenopause and the menopause, they are physiological. We are all going to go through this. And we all go through this with varying symptoms. And these symptoms can affect our quality of life. And sometimes these symptoms may not affect our quality of life. We sometimes might not have the whole barrage of the perimenopausal and menopausal symptoms, so no vasomotor, everything doesn't come at the same time. Mm-hmm. So the answer to that question is really a careful history. Ask the woman, how bad is this memory fog? How is it affecting your quality of life? What else have you done to help with the memory fog and the feeling of being out of control? And if this is affecting her quality of life, then why not?
Why not?
HRT can be used for just a single symptom of the menopause, as well as being used for women who suffer from significant amounts of, because it improves every marker. So both vasomotor, the hot flushes, the night sweats, the memory, the bones, it affects everything.
It's what I find really hard and I'm in that kind of early 40s, is I'm like, is this PMS? Is it perimenopause? Is this grief? Am I exhausted?
Absolutely.
What are we talking about here, Dr.
Absolutely.
Mariam? The list of perimenopause is extensive. Dr. Mariam, I will tell you with us today. We're going to have a bit of a quick fire round on the text line and hopefully help as many people as possible. As I said, no embarrassment, no such thing as a silly question. It can be seeking some clarity on a term, it can indeed be getting some specific information to whatever you're going through right now. We've had a message from Kay saying, how long does it take for your period to start again after you stop breastfeeding?
It's an excellent question. So when you stop breastfeeding, your periods are not going to come back almost immediately, at least not always. Usually you would need to give yourself at least 3 to 6 months before the periods actually start. And that also depends on a lot of things, because when women say they stop breastfeeding, sometimes they are still doing the nighttime cuddle.
Yeah, it can tail off.
It tails off, exactly. And so you really just have to have that prolactin, that so-called milk hormone. The levels have to drop sufficiently such that, the periods can start. And so any type of nipple stimulation is going to delay the periods a little bit.
Which is where I think there's a bit of confusion around how effective breastfeeding is as so-called contraception.
Absolutely.
Can have some Irish twins going on in the family.
Absolutely.
Okay, we've had a message. We were talking there about links between obesity and infertility. And Dee says, I have lean PCOS.
Yes.
Saying, I'm 33, married 4.5 years. I've read about PCOS, and everything I read says that if you want to get pregnant, you need to lose weight, stop being obese. But I have lean PCOS, so I'd welcome advice. This means that when we're thinking about kind of some of the so-called symptoms and factors of polycystic ovary syndrome, being overweight is one of them. That's not the case in this message.
Absolutely, Helen. And thank you for this listener for talking about lean PCOS, because it's real. We are seeing increasingly women who do not have a phenotype that would suggest that they've got PCOS. PCOS is multisystemic. It affects so many different things. So it's not just the glucocorticoids and the storage of fat. It's not just that. It could also affect periods. It could affect acne, skin. It could affect moods, bones. It can affect so many different aspects. And women do not always present with weight gain. As the primary problem in PCOS. So PCOS is a diagnosis that has been bandied around very loosely, and you need to come in and have an assessment. And that assessment would include the history. It would include some biochemistry, blood testing to see. And actually, more and more, we're looking and seeing that polycystic ovaries is generally associated with the raised testosterone, the androgens. And if there's no androgen increase, then the symptoms are not so significant, and you don't have to have drugs like Ozempic, etc.
So would we suggest to Dee to come in and have a bit of a profile, a bit of a history taken?
For sure.
Okay,
for sure.
There you go. Hope that helps, Dee. Last question of the day, just a couple of minutes left. And I'm so sorry to this listener who's been in touch for your loss, saying, I suffered a miscarriage back in March at approximately 5 weeks.
I'm so sorry.
I really am. And asking, when is it safe to try again? Now, the common wisdom that I heard when, a few years ago when this was on my radar was 3 months.
Correct.
Is this based on anything, or is it really?
Honestly, Helen, it's not based on scientific evidence at all.
Okay.
3 months was just the general number that was bandied around that clinicians felt would give the woman time to establish regular periods, would give the woman time to recover from sort of psychology of pregnancy loss, early pregnancy loss. And this is, we understand now that early pregnancy loss is just as psychologically stressful as pregnancy loss later on.
Absolutely.
And so it's highly individualized. If a woman has had pregnancy loss at 5.5 weeks and you establish your period, immediately you establish your period, your body is ready to be pregnant. But that's just half of the story. You have to look at the psychology of it. Are you ready? Is your family ready to start again? Mm-hmm. And so it's highly individualized. And so one woman is ready the next month and another woman needs 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
So, look at it from a personal point of view and just realize that once you've had the first period, you're very likely and you're physically ready to become pregnant again.
Such lovely advice. Thank you, as ever.
You're welcome.
Dr. Myron, I've had a number of people asking for your details. You you have your own clinic there,
yes,
in Healthcare City.
Indeed.
With your permission, if people want to send me the word doctor or doc, can I share your details? Would that be okay?
For sure. Okay. It would be such a pleasure.
And no questions asked, no name needed, but Dr. Mariam is there delivering babies and helping you get pregnant and all the way through, as we've talked about today, HRT as well. So thank you as ever.
Thank you for
really,
having me.
Really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
And get back to catching some babies.
Will do.
I'm sure there's some
will do.
I've
got to wear my skates, actually.
Dr. Mariam Awate with us today.
This content is for informational purposes only and does not intend to substitute professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
We're delving into the intriguing and often debated topic of electromagnetic field, so EMF radiation from devices we use daily to invisible waves that do surround us. It's become a really integral part of modern life, but it's also stirred concerns around potential health effects too. So joining us today from Blue Shield Middle East, we've got the MD, Chris Pascoe, who, well, you've had personal experience of this, and we're going to be talking about some of the health concerns, especially as families as well. I need you to talk to me as if I am 10, okay?
Sure thing.
Because I know this is very much your bread and butter, and we are going to talk tech because I know this is a big passion of yours. Can you explain what EMF radiation is, Chris?
Sure thing. Thanks, Helen.
Pleasure.
So EMF radiation is electromagnetic field radiation. So this is generally the radiation that comes from electronic devices is what we think about it. But they're also two different forms of, or two main sources of electromagnetic fields. So one are natural forms, which are created by the Earth's magnetic poles. And even humans have their own electromagnetic field that we create as we're walking around and interacting with people. But then, of course, the EMFs that we're mostly concerned about are the EMFs that are emitted from excessive use of electronic devices. Now, in small doses, it's believed to be fairly harmless. But however, in the past 25 years, there's been exponential growth in terms of the use of electronic devices in people's homes, and particularly Wi-Fi-enabled devices.
Okay, so the Wi-Fi routers and, you know, things that might be addressed, so your tablets, your phones, yeah, speakers, you know, all of that.
Yeah.
Where I've heard people being most concerned, and you actually alluded to it off air, is when you're choosing somewhere to live. Mm. And, you know, you see people posting saying, you know, found this great villa, it's at a great price, but it's next to this huge mast. What would you do? You know, when people saying, oh, well, you know, I would never live there because I want to protect my children, or that's complete nonsense. You know, do you go around wearing a tinfoil hat? Do you use a phone? So, you know, why would you be worried about this? So it is quite a polarizing topic. But I wanted to ask about the data. You know, what is some of that latest scientific research about potential health effects of EMF from devices that, you know, one's next to me right now, you know, cell phones, routers. I don't even want to think about what's happening in the studio right now. But what does the science say?
Yes. So as we were talking about before off air, in terms of a personal experience, looking for a place to live was where myself and my wife came to become aware of EMF radiation. So that led us down a rabbit hole. And we found that there were all these sorts of reports that were surfacing that there are potential harm that can come from overuse of EMF emitting devices. So what we actually did was we got a RF meter and we went around and all the house viewings.
Where did you get it from?
We were able to purchase one from the US. We had to ship it in from the US. But there are companies that are available that will come and do RF readings in your house and tell you what the radiation levels are.
So that became a factor for you for where you chose to raise the family.
Exactly. Yeah. So where we were first looking to live or to purchase a property was where there were lots of high voltage power lines, which you can see across the skyline of Dubai. And one real estate agent actually turned us on to mobile phone masks being an issue as well, because they emit a higher frequency of radiation. And so that was definitely something that we had to be concerned about. And then that really influenced our decision on where we were going to live. And definitely one thing that we looked for was a place with lots of trees, because living material, plants, animals and humans actually do a really good job of absorbing EMF radiation. So if you're able to put plants up in your gardens, they can actually work a lot to block a lot of that ambient EMF that you get from those external factors.
I have to say I did a little bit of research, but then I started to get confused, which is why I'm glad you're here. Is there a difference between ionizing and non-ionizing radiation, Chris?
Yes. So ionizing radiation is what we know 100% is harmful to humans. So that's things that come from like gamma rays, so that's radiation, ultraviolet rays, and you can actually see the cellular damage that people experience when they get burnt, they get sunburnt. Mm-hmm. So that is a form of ionizing radiation. Non-ionizing radiation is what comes from your electrical devices. So that's at a much lower frequency. But the concern is that with so much more of it, so much greater exposure that we're coming across now, that we could be facing issues.
You mentioned there about this idea of, you know, getting burnt by, you know, certain types of radiation. When we're talking about EMF exposure and I guess what we might kind of deem normal, depending on the devices we use, the technology we're surrounded by, are there any specific symptoms that people might, you know, have you know, experienced now? And how actually common are those symptoms?
Mm. Well, that's the thing. A lot of people are very unaware of how EMF is affecting them. Some people run their own tests. Like a big example and a big piece of advice is talking on your mobile phone, where possible, put that on speaker and hold it away from your head. A lot of people that are sensitive to EMF, myself included, I can actually feel a headache coming on when I'm using my phone for too long for extended periods of time.
Tell me, Chris, when you walked into the studio, would you let your wife work here? I suppose is the easiest way of putting it.
Mm-hmm. Well, thankfully, I'm carrying a portable device with me.
So you're safe.
That actually goes a 3 meter radius in the room.
Oh, good.
So you're even enjoying safety, EMF safety.
Do you want to stick it on the desk and leave it here? No, but in all seriousness, when we're talking about, you know, devices that are connected to Wi-Fi being, you know, potential sources of EMF, and you know, I'm surrounded now by one, two, three screens here, four screens, five screens. Six. Let's say 12 screens in the street. It's a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So people that do work in things like telecommunications, I guess even when we're looking at radiation in medical space as well, are there particular industries or demographics, you know, children groups that are particularly vulnerable?
Yes, definitely. There are particularly people that are exposed to EMF radiation on a frequent basis, because it's believed that the more that you're exposed to EMF, the more exposure you have, the more it's going to affect you. EMF radiation affects you on a cellular level. As I was talking about the sunburn before, where you can actually see it, but it actually is deep inside underneath your skin that it is affecting you. Children are actually a lot more susceptible than adults. A lot of that is because they're still growing. For instance, their skulls are still thinner than what an adult's is. And developmentally, their brains are still developing. So, I mean, if you look at what it was like 25 years ago or in the 80s when I was growing up as a child, the amount of EMF exposure that the average person has today is somewhere from 100 to 1,000 times more than what it was 25 years ago, let alone what it would have been in the 80s.
Right. Let's go to the text line. Manny saying, I'm just wondering if the battery on electric cars is safe, e.g. to sit near. Does it produce electromagnetic radiation or any other kind?
It definitely does produce electromagnetic radiation. And there are safety standards that are in place that governments need to adhere to. The WHO has also set a lot of guidelines into there. And actually the Dubai government, the UAE government, does a great job in actually making sure that products adhere to those guidelines. However, it is the best thing to do is to maintain distance or limit usage as much as possible.
Which brings me to my question here from Eileen, saying echo dot radiation exposure for kids. Should I be worried? 10-year-old and 12-year-old would love one for their bedroom for music, asking questions, stories. If they were radiation free, I'd get them without hesitation, but I'm worried about increasing their exposure to radiation on top of the usual internet, Wi-Fi, etc. Reddit should be used several meters away from the child at all times. Everyone I know seems to have one and no one seems to care. So am I being unreasonable?
Definitely not being unreasonable. And that is a big part of the issue, is awareness. People, quite frankly, don't know or are unaware of EMF radiation. With the Echo Dot, that is an Internet of Things device, so it is connected to Wi-Fi, so it is receiving and emitting a Wi-Fi signal back and forth, which is an EMF electromagnetic field. So there is some pollution that is happening there. Now, the best practice is to maintain a distance. I mean, an Echo Dot or a smart speaker in someone's bedroom, it's a lot similar to having a baby monitor in a baby's room. It all emits EMF. So it's, do you or do you not choose to use the device? I'm a bit of a technophile. I'm the first one to use my phone in the morning to be on there. I have fast internet connection. So the steps that you take to mitigate those risks, they need to take into consideration how you're using these connected devices. Mm.
You said before you've got a device you're carrying with you, but you can get devices for homes, for businesses, wellness spaces, I'm sure, would be interested in kind of creating these zones where people can, unplug, so to speak. Mm. What other innovations are there, whether it's at home or at work?
So there are other steps that people can take to or reduce or mitigate EMF radiation.
Always it for planting trees?
Yep, planting trees is one of them. You can purchase Faraday fabric and you can put that over appliances like your microwave.
What?
And things like that while it's on. A good
really?
Practice
Does
is actually...
Really? Does anyone actually do that?
Yeah, people do that.
Really?
We do it at our house.
Do you?
Yes.
I'm going to Google Faraday fabric. Like, they'll just stick them in a Faraday cage. Okay.
Yeah. All right, go on. And then there are other things that people can do. They can paint their villas in EMF blocking paints, but it's very expensive. Mm. But what that's going to do is actually affect your internet speed around your house and how devices are connected. So using a device such as a Blue Shield device allows you to use the internet and your devices as normal while staying protected from EMF.
I was at an event last night and a lady held her phone up and I was like, what's that? She said, I bought this crystal from Amazon to protect from EMF radiation. And I was like, wow, okay, this sounds a bit out there. So what's that about?
That is a little bit out there.
Okay.
I think I'm a skeptical person at the best of times. And when I first discovered the effects of EMF radiation, I went down a rabbit hole and trying to work out what are the issues or how ways to mitigate it. And yeah, there are certain crystals and things like that work to absorb the EMF, if that's possible.
I don't know.
Whereas my research has shown that you need a coherent frequency to knock out the EMF.
So technology against technology, fight the good fight. With some science.
Yes, exactly. That's
hey, listen,
exactly.
I like crystals as much as the next person. I had a lovely time in Holly Holistic at the weekend. It was great. We've had a number of people asking about hearing the interview again. The podcast will be available this evening. About the product again. So I guess Blue Shield No E is the best thing to Google. And if people want to send me the word health, I'll send the link. Would that make sense?
Yep.
Chris, thank you so much.
Thanks,
You've
Helen.
Got me thinking about quitting my job and going to live beside a lake somewhere and just play with a piece of string for the rest of my life. Does that sound reasonable?
Yeah. Okay. People do it.
People do it. I can see the appeal. Last Wednesday, British television host and celebrity doctor Michael Mosley went missing while holiday on a Greek island, and while a full coroner's report has not yet been finalised, heat has been implicated as a factor that might have contributed to his death. Greek police believing he had died of heat exhaustion after losing consciousness while walking in 40 degree temperatures. Now, you don't need me to tell you that it's getting hot out there, guys. So we're turning our attentions this hour to heat stroke. What can we do to be hydrated? Are electrolytes worth the money? Why do some of us sweat more than others? Dr. Wajdi Albonji is with us today, internal medicine specialist at Faki University Hospital. By the way, I love your hospital. I did a tour of it a while ago and it is absolutely fantastic. It yes. really is.
It's a state of art hospital, and the vision is so big. Yeah,
I mean, you know, so much, you know, planting and, you know, kind of this idea about healing and was just gorgeous. And then you've got a robotic pharmacy. It's very cool. Great to have you with us today, Doctor. I want to start by asking about how the human body regulates temperature normally. What systems are in place to make sure we are, you know, staying at that kind of 37, you know, ish degrees.
Yeah. Thank you for inviting me.
My pleasure.
But to understand heat stroke, you want to understand this mechanism. It's a wonderful mechanism, and it works like the same mechanism of a car.
Okay.
How the engines control temperature. The same in our body. Actually, when we expose to heat, there is like a system, a gland in our brain called, it's like thermostat regulation, okay? And this is reacted to our body when exposed to heat to control the sweat mechanism. And the sweating, it's tried to evaporate, and the evaporate try to control temperature. Mm-hmm. This is how we cool down the when we expose to heat.
And this is humans, dogs pant. You know, they have different, you know, different mechanisms in place.
Sometimes it's because we expose the skin. Skin
yes.
is something sometimes is more exposed. Why? Skin is so sensitive, and there is a lot of capillaries around the skin. And when there is a vasodilation under heat, this is mean the heat, the blood get heated. Okay, the body push to vasodilation effect under the skin because you want to sweat,
mm-hmm.
okay? Because they want to take this fluid to take it out, to take this thermoregulation,
smart.
To make it. But when there is a lot of the vasodilation, and the skin reach under certain temperature to 8 liters per minute circulation, because body make a lot of effort to this thermoregulation, a lot of energy doing expended for this thermoregulation
system.
So
the body can't keep up with the extreme
so, yeah.
heat. Oof. Now, I said to you this off air, I don't sweat a lot. I can do an exercise class and, you know, the person next to me will be in like a puddle on their spin bike and I'm like, well, lower back's a bit damp and the fringe, you know, the bangs are compromised. Some people sweat a lot and that can be a clinical diagnosis. Some people don't seem to sweat at all. How does that impact our ability to regulate our temperature?
Yes, sweating is a lot of density of gland. There is a gland of sweat under the skin. There is a certain density. Maybe sometimes when you come from a cold country, so maybe you don't have this density enough. There is some genetic factor. But, you know, sometimes when we have a lot of sweating, this is mean we are prone to dehydration.
Mm-hmm.
And dehydration is one of the key elements of the heat stroke.
Now, I've seen a lot of products marketing around hydration and electrolytes in particular. Now, most of us listening today are not athletes. We don't necessarily need performance drinks. But I read recently a doctor saying, you know, actually save you money on the, you know, performance enhancing drinks. Have something like, I don't know, would you know what orange squash is? Like a drink with...
For sure.
Yeah, okay. Because some countries are like, what's orange squash? Like a cordial. So, you know, big thing of water, some sugary squash and a few drops of electrolytes is basically a power drink. What do electrolytes do and how do they aid in us staying hydrated?
Yes. So the balance of fluid in our body related to the amount of sodium and potassium and magnesium and a lot of this. So, and the one of the earliest signs of dehydration and losing electrolytes is cramp. So when we lose like potassium and magnesium. So in this case, when like on the beach, some people like there's some cramp, even if around the water, these people are dehydrated.
Wow.
So always when we want to drink water in hot weather, always mix it with electrolyte, especially under exercise.
Is there a way of calculating how much water we should be drinking per day? Because there's lots of kind of debunking this idea of you need 8 glasses or 10 glasses. Does it depend on our body size and composition?
Yes, usually between 2.5 to can reach to 3.5 in summertime, liter per day. So it's like total fluid around with coffee, water, and all of that. So maybe if we track this, it will better. And if you are taking any diuretic effect, for example, coffee is a diuretic effect, beer is a diuretic, or any medication. Your people under medication are at high risk for heat stroke because they are prone to dehydration. Because when this exposure to the heat, a lot reach to organ failure.
We've got internal medicine specialist, Dr. Wajdi Albolji. He is with us today from Faki University Hospital. We've been talking about how our bodies regulate temperature, why electrolytes are so important, especially as we get into these hotter months. So I wanted to ask you about the primary symptoms of heat stroke. And, you know, what do we need to be, you know, aware of? What are those red flags, doctor?
The red flag is sometimes flushing of the skin. The patients like feel tachycardic, rapid respiration, and sometimes cannot focus. He start losing focus. Okay. So and sometimes delirium, like he not aware where he is. This is like an advanced way, but and cramp as we discussed, like cannot. The muscle tonicity decreasing, or there is spasticity of some muscles in extremities. So, yikes. In this case, for example, patients under exhaustion, for example, biking, hiking, this is different than someone like sitting on the beach.
Mm-hmm.
This is like exhaustion heat stroke and non-exhaustion heat stroke. And definitely, when the muscle pumping, the risk is under heat stroke is high because the heart is already. On race, and there is a lot of risk, especially for what happened with the case for someone above 65 with hiking or biking in the road. And this is a lot of, because the thermoregulation system affected with aging.
Okay.
So aging factor in kids and in aging elderly.
So two vulnerable groups there.
And there's some medication, medication effect, any medication. That can cause any chronic disease can put someone patient at heat stroke. And so you want to take care about your fluids. You focus about that. When you see any alarms, just like call somebody to help.
So let's say you are hiking. Do not hike in June, July in the UAE, folks. Let's say you are hiking and you meet someone who is exactly that, you know, cramping, disorientated, flushed. What should you be doing to help them? What are some of the immediate steps you should take?
It's based on the stage. So if I'm taking care of this patient at early stage, like he feel drowsy, lethargic, flushy and tachycardic, but like blood pressure is maintained, temperature is not reaching 40, 41.
Oof.
So in this case, like I remove the clothes and starting to cooling, the cooling blanket. Try to cooling it anyway. So the body, if he can't tolerate water, I give him the water. If he's not conscious enough to drink water, we're going to take care of aspiration. Because if he's not enough consciousness, I cannot give him water. So in this case, I will ask for medical help to try to put IVs and all of that. So if you take care of patients on the street in this early phase, you can save life. Because it's heat shock is lethal and preventable.
Mm-hmm.
Easy to prevent. And if you like miss it between 30 minutes to 2 hours, someone will gonna lose life. So it can kill.
Thank you so much for raising awareness around this. I really, really appreciate your time. We've been talking a bit about longevity off air, so let's get into that on another day. How does that sound?
For sure.
I will warn you, he will make you give up refined sugar, gluten, and 3 other things that I've blocked out because I don't want to do it. Dr. Wajda, in the meantime, though, Dr. Wajda, you can be found at the Faki University Hospital, internal medicine specialist. Really appreciate your time. And see you soon, I hope. Stay safe.
See you. Bye-bye.
Stay cool.
Thank you.
And thank you again. and thank you for downloading this episode of the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. Don't forget, you can subscribe. You'll get direct to your phone as soon as it's out. And you can listen to me live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Monday to Friday between 2 and 5 p.m.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.